Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome from our studio in the office of the European Data Protection Supervisor. I would like to welcome all the participants. First of all, Ursula Hughes, Ai-Han Nguyen, and Barbara Prysak. Ursula is a professor of labor and globalization at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. Aiha is a project lead in the initiative Social Instabilities in Labor Futures and Data and Society. She connects with us from New York. And Barbara is the member of the European Group on Ethics in Science and New Technologies and the professor of political science at the University of Vienna and at King's College in London. We would like to invite all the other participants of this chat, of this conversation online, to send us questions to the three guests we have that we will be able to use in the second part of this discussion. So, employers-employees relations, that's very legal approach to this subject, because actually we are spending one third of our lifetime at work. So work is not only the relation between employees, relation between the employer and employees, or between different employers. It's actually a big part of our social life, and big part of sometimes family life as well, especially when we are talking about the family businesses all around. So this is more than just the work. This is more than just the place where we are going to. This is the part of our life which we hardly can separate sometimes from the other places that we are doing our time. So I would like to go directly to our guests, maybe starting with Barbara. Barbara, as I said, she is the member of the European Group on Ethics in Science and New Technologies. And this group, as I know, has recently published the opinion which is titled Future of Work, Future of Society. We are not going to talk today about the robots taking over the work from the human beings, but I understand that your approach in the European Group on Ethics in Science and the New Technologies is much broader. And I understand that there is a strong link between the latest developments in the world of work and the future we are creating for the next generation. So could you please explain us why the group saw the need to take such a broad approach in this opinion?
Thank you very much, Wojciech, for this for the very good way in which you introduced this question, and also for hosting this podcast today. I can't really take credit on behalf of the European Group on Ethics for the wide framing of our report. The report is called, as you mentioned, The Future of Work, The Future of Our Society. It was actually Commissioner Muedas who, in one of our discussions we had with him, he said, well, we give you this mandate to produce a report on the future of work, but I guess it will really be a report on the future of society. And we took that, I mean, first everyone sort of smiled, but then we took this very We realized that there was a lot of truth and wisdom in this, because currently we are in a society where more and more aspects of our lives are being datafied, meaning that things that we used to do before that nobody knew about are now captured with data, and increasingly digital data. And so many of our practices, including how we live and how we work, are affected by this at the moment. So it's not that, you know, the problem was created by robots who suddenly come and steal our jobs, but that the changing nature of work is really due to a confluence of a lot of political, economic, social, and technological developments that change the way we live and work. And so we mean this quite literally, and not as a kind of trivial statement, but as a deep statement that the future of work is the future of our society. And we want to create it because we do not believe that technology tells us what to do. We believe that we should put technologies in the service of social and other values, and that by creating policies we can actually shape the future of work and the future of our societies.
Okay, and you said about this datification of the world which we are living in, and that always reminds me that what Professor Maya Schoenberger said about datification of the whole environment that we are living in. So are you also approaching the problem that the data on our behavior, which is not connected with the labor, is staying in the hands of the employers or in the hands of the other managers which are around the workplace?
That's part of what we address in our opinion. But I think we go wider than that. We say in our opinion that if we want to create a future that fosters European values such as social justice and solidarity, we really need to have a much more inclusive understanding of work. So as an analytic term, work needs to start to include those things that are not captured by paid employment at the moment, which includes much of the more invisible informal work that people are doing. So we need to look at work in terms of activities that create value for our society. And of course, that in turn poses the question of what types of activities and tasks are valuable for our society. And we should try to enhance and support and remunerate those kinds of tasks that are valuable for society and not things that are necessarily, can obtain high salaries at the labor market, because the relationship between what people make and what their jobs contribute to society are very complex, to put it euphemistically. So there's some jobs that get paid very well that create very little value, and there are activities of people that are not remunerated at all in financial terms, and they create a lot of value for society. And in this context, digital practices and data are becoming increasingly important in shaping our practices and also as assets. Business plans and business opportunities are created around data, and to a large extent this is positive, but it's not only positive. And it's certainly not positive in the way that we're doing this now, that we are equating data with oil, and pretending that the data are something that is just given to us by nature, and the corporations that are mining and analyzing the data then start to own them. But datafication is a process that is supported by public infrastructures. Data are created by us, the people, as citizens, as patients. And I think we need new ways of collective decision-making and ownership and responsibility for the data that become a more important factor in our economies and also in many domains of employment. And one aspect that we also look at in our opinion is, of course, the ways in which data are being used to monitor and score employees and job seekers. But this is only a small subset of the challenges and opportunities related to the datafication and the digitization of our societies.
Thank you for this introduction that is actually taking us directly to the second subject which I wanted to discuss, because one of the most striking innovation that technologies can bring to the world of work is digital management and digital supervision. Many workers today, many people at work today are hired, monitored, and also fired using often algorithmic, often remote digital surveillance and rating systems that are assessing the work and the behavior of the people. We know all the example of Uber drivers and how they get deactivated, as it said, once their client is rating scores below a certain threshold. But I also heard about devices that are used in the work, like sociometric badges, sociometers, which are wearable electronic devices which are capable to automatically measure the amount of face-to-face interaction of the worker, and this automatically measuring individual and collective patterns of behavior. In your explainers on algorithmic management and workplace monitoring, together with your colleague Alexandra Matescu at the Data and Society, you have analyzed the main trends. You have also recently published a blog post summarizing these conclusions. Could you give us an overview of the most striking developments that you heard about and you are aware of? And of the most striking examples of this digital management and its implication.
Yes, thank you, Wojciech. First, I want to say thank you for letting me participate in this, and I'd be happy to do that. We at Data and Society have been looking at how algorithmic systems coupled with new forms of workplace monitoring are becoming prolific in many forms of employment within gig but also outside of it, and how the ability of these systems to improve efficiency of workflows and allow for dynamic changes are shifting work. And they do it by more easily processing data that is often generated by workers themselves to reference what Barbara is mentioning about the unpaid labor that goes into making these systems work. And the data-centric technologies can then dynamically look at this data, pull in seemingly unrelated data in order to do a variety of things to manage workplaces, including controlling workforces, experimenting with workflows. As you mentioned, it can monitor through various monitoring systems, detect behaviors of workers, and use that to determine if something is abnormal or deviant. And that can then also be used to evaluate one's performance and ultimately automate or semi-automate tasks. And so the result of this is that the scope, scale, and purpose of monitoring and management has grown and changed significantly. And employers, as a result, can surveil workers for many reasons and use the technologies for both beneficial ends for their ends, such as protecting assets and controlling costs and improving work efficiency, but also for extractive ends. And the tools, the monitoring and surveillance tools that allow for much of this data to be collected, we generally broke into three main categories. One was predicting and flagging tools. These are the tools that monitor employee behavior to identify their characteristics and performance. For example, point of sale systems, which can see if a sales representative is processing too many returns, and using proxies and metrics that measure this behavior to hit on and determine relationships between activities. There are remote monitoring and time tracking tools that manage large dispersed workforces, like GPS location and activity trackers and remote sensors that are so common in ride hailing and workers who are doing work through labor platforms. And then finally, you hit on the use of biometric and health data that is also collected often in work environments through wearables, such as Fitbits, but also fitness tracking apps that employees download onto their phones, or biometric timekeeping, such as fingerprint scans and even facial recognition these days. And those efforts are used to improve health measures. The issues that come with a lot of these, with biometrics in particular, is this actually related to the work that one does? Does one's health and one's smoking habits or one's eating habits or exercise habits really have anything to do with how workers do their activities? It's possible, but it's not a clear connection. Secondly, the remote monitoring and timekeeping, as well as predicting and flagging tools, often the flow of information is one-directional. So it's the employers that have the information, and they will use that information to move large numbers of workers and nudge workers to behave in certain ways that advantage the company, but not necessarily the employees and the workers.
You have touched a very important point about this one-way direction for the data. That's always interesting for me because, well, I'm an employer. I was a commissioner on the national level, and I'm right now the deputy commissioner for data protection in the European Union institutions, bodies and agencies. And I have an office of 100 people that are working for me. And in this sense, I'm really interested in somehow assessing how they work, but also helping them in their work. So let me ask the provocative question. So maybe it's good. Maybe this is data that really may help the employees as well. And the problem is only that it should be used by both employer and the employee. And I heard about workers using an access right, access to personal data rights, in order to collect information about the additional time they spend in the work, the overtime they spend, and using that for their own purposes and requiring the right and remuneration for the work they did, because they can prove that they are doing more than the average worker in the company. So maybe the lack of information on the side of employees is the first problem that we have to deal with.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Barbara may have mentioned this, but I'll reiterate that these are essentially tools. There is not necessarily a negative and a positive, you know, they don't behave in one particular way. It's based on those who have control and who own the technology to use it a particular way. You're absolutely right. Uber drivers have been able to install their own surveillance systems, dash cams, in order to prove that a passenger asked them to take a circuitous route, or it could be used to do any number of things that could help. I think ultimately it comes down to these are company policies. It's the owners of the technology that really can choose how to use it in whatever way they choose. I would say, though, in our experience, generally, the tools have been used for the benefit of the company. For example, if we're talking about ride hailing, drivers don't necessarily know how much they'll get paid when they get a job. The point of that is that way, if a driver had all of the complete information, they may make a different decision about whether to give that ride or not. So by doing this, the companies can more easily nudge workers in order to behave in a way that benefits corporations.
Thank you very much. And Ursula, you have been working extensively on gig economy. Much of what we have heard from IHA closely related to your research. You conducted in-depth interviews with platform workers that shed light on the realities of their working lives. Could you tell us more about the consequences of these new ways of organizing the work, which consequences it has on the workers? Linked to this, in a recent article in The Guardian, you questioned the use of artificial intelligence to monitor the employees, because it will eventually counter the innovation. Why do you think that digital monitoring can harm the workers' creativity and their general performance?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to join this extraordinarily important discussion and for taking the initiative in raising these questions. I should explain that the work I've been doing on the gig economy with colleagues at the University of Hertfordshire is part of a much broader project where we've conducted surveys in 13 European countries looking at what you might call digital work organisation practices right across the whole labour market. And what we are finding is that the practices of the online platforms, which we all hear so much about, especially companies like Uber and Deliveroo and so on, that these practices are actually spread much more broadly across society. And it could be argued that we are seeing in Europe now almost the emergence of a new normative model of work, of which you could say online platforms are an extreme example, whereby people are increasingly interface with their organizations they work for via a digital interface rather than having a direct personal contact with a manager. They interface through online forms, and of course in the process they are generating data simply by communicating in that way. They are expected increasingly to be available 24/7 on a sort of just-in-time basis. They are monitored and surveyed in various different ways. They use digital platforms to not only to tell them when a task is waiting, but also to log their working hours, to for all kinds of routine administrative work, and more importantly, that the quality of their work is increasingly assessed by customer ratings. We're all familiar with the kind of customer ratings of Uber workers, but actually customer ratings is a much broader phenomena. For instance, university lecturers are rated by their students. Hospital workers are rated by their patients. Call center workers are rated by the callers that they deal with, and so on. And these practices are really spreading very, very widely. And it seems to me that apart from the kind of obvious ethical issues which have already been raised about who owns the data, who has access to it, what's done with it after the worker has left the job, you know, is it made available to other people, how can it be challenged, etc., etc., there are all those kind of issues which are important. But it seems to me that a more fundamental ethical issue really is that if we live in a world where people are measured by the quantitative data that is generated around their activity, their managers or other institutions with which they interact, they see only the data. And what is not captured quantitatively, the qualitative aspects of work are missed. They're squeezed out, they become completely invisible. And in many kinds of jobs, it's those qualitative aspects that are the most important. For instance, for elderly people who are dependent on care workers to come and look after them, it's much more important to that elderly person. I speak as a rather elderly person myself. It's much more important to have like the quality of the care, to have a friendly person who you feel cares about you, who treats you with respect. Those kinds of things are much more important than, you know, how quickly the task is finished and so on. And it's precisely those qualitative aspects that get squeezed out. The same thing happens with creative work. The more that creative workers are monitored, and of course, if you work for a platform through a platform like Upwork or something like that, the tendency is for people to evaluate your work in terms of quantitative indicators. What gets left out of that is the actual creativity in the work itself. If you're a creative worker, you might not, a writer, for instance, you might not keep your fingers on the keyboard all the time. You might actually want to get up and walk to the window and look at the trees and have a thought and then go back to your keyboard. And that interval, when you're doing actually the most important part of your job, that creative part, is the part that is not captured. So I think this, I think there's a real problem around the work quality, which also, of course, means the quality of life for all the people who interact with those workers, if we're talking about service workers. Now, the answer that the technocrats will give to that question, they'll say, oh, well, that's where the user ratings come in. You know, we get the qualitative information because by measuring user satisfaction. But there's a huge problem with user satisfaction, and that is that, what is called algorithmic bias. There's an awful lot of evidence, for instance, that university lecturers who are women get lower ratings systematically than their colleagues who are men, that black Uber drivers in the United States get lower ratings than white Uber drivers, and so on. So one could say that the wisdom of the crowd kind of becomes, if you like, the prejudice of the crowd writ large. And by putting our faith in algorithms that seem to be neutral, but which are actually fed with data which has inherent bias in it, what we there is a huge risk that we start undoing all the good work that's been done across Europe in the last 30 years in trying to put into place equal opportunities policies, fairness, respect, regardless of ethnicity and gender and so on, that all those, so to speak, level playing fields that the European social model has tried so hard to put into place are being unpicked through the bias of the algorithms.
You said about the bias which is done in the rankings because of opinions of the people. So maybe this datification may mean that we should get more objective opinion taken out of data, not out from the opinions.
The thing is, we need a balance. You can't just ignore the opinions of users. Clearly, we need mechanisms for making sure that there's, so to speak, 360-degree feedback as much as possible around any service which is provided to the public. But relying too much on user ratings, it seems to me, can be very deprofessionalizing. For instance, I was recently asked to rate the quality of a hospital experience. Now, it could be that a nurse, who treated me inflicted quite a lot of pain, and I was tempted under the influence of my heavy medication to give her a very low rating because it hurt, but in fact, she could have been doing something that was extremely medically important and that, it's just a treatment that hurts, and she shouldn't be penalized for that by the ignorant opinion of a member of the public. She should be judged by her peers, professional peers and superiors, it seems to me, in the same way that if you're a university lecturer who teaches a rather unpopular course, in the social sciences, an awful lot of students hate doing a statistics course, but we don't want to send social scientists out in the world who are statistically illiterate just because they all don't like doing the statistics course. There's a point at which professional judgment has to enter into dialogue with public opinion.
Okay, you wanted to comment.
No, I wanted to actually contribute to what Ursula was saying regarding monitoring and evaluation of employee behavior. So what we've also noticed is that oftentimes it's only the behavior which is measurable by a machine, which is acknowledged as work and credited and paid for. So in that instance, a lot of work which is done, which is hard to quantify by a system, whether that's, years of experience, it doesn't get captured, and instead systems will choose proxies for a particular type of behavior or even to represent experience that may actually not be reflective. One example that we've seen in care work is the number of years of experience that a worker has been providing nanny service or in-home supportive care isn't as easily measured through a platform as, say, well, how quickly do you respond to clients? And that becomes something that's valued more, and that in some bizarre way, it speaks to this question of are we adequately valuing work, or are we allowing a system to determine what that is for us? And then that also leads to this sense of some workers of their experience and their professionalism being challenged by a system that is sort of in some ways either flattening or changing the criteria that we define to have to be good work.
Thank you. And Barbara?
I would really like to echo what Ursula and Aicha were saying about the many ways in which over-reliance on, let's stick with the term algorithmic regulation, are problematic. But I would like to go further than that and say that it is important to keep in mind what we are losing as a society, and both Ursula and Aicha alluded to that as well. What we are losing as a society when we delegate a lot of the things that we used to do in a relational human way to, quote unquote, data, we are neglecting the social and psychological factors of what happens to human beings when they feel they're constantly monitored. I mean, surveillance studies scholars have written about this for a long time. What do we lose if we stop trusting each other, but if we say, well, it can't hurt if we monitor you? And let's see, you know, the data and the technology speak the truth, and that truth counts more than our own human voice. So I think we should not only reject in some cases the process of datafying our lives because of inherent biases and because of other types of problems and because of accountability problems that we haven't even started to go into here yet. But we should just avoid it in some instances, because we decide that, you know, not being seen doesn't mean that we have something to hide, and not being seen means that we are affirming ourselves as human beings and as a society and as people who trust each other without checking through technological tools whether other people actually deserve the trust. I hope and I believe that that will be a value that increasingly employees will claim. They will say, I'm not going to work in your company if you monitor. And I think we need to really stand up together as a collective, and especially those of us who are in privileged positions and who can choose where they work. We need to speak for those who cannot choose where they work. And we need to say we reject it. And we have an opportunity as societies in Europe to also say that some practices are so ethically problematic that they should be outlawed. So technology is not, as I mentioned earlier, this is not a natural force that happens and we, you know, we can just, like a tsunami, we can't even effectively protect ourselves from it. We can absolutely protect ourselves from the consequences of this. And in some cases, I think it's better to say we do not want datification in this case, because we're losing something human. And even if we thereby forego some efficiency benefits and some financial profits, we will still forego it, because at the end of the day, what's really valuable is not money. I mean, money is valuable as a tool for something else, but not as an end in itself. And with all the measuring frenzy, we sometimes forget to think, and here I'm echoing Mariana Mazzucato and other people who are making this argument, we're forgetting to talk about what's valuable.
Barbara, you have been calling to look at these challenges of the workplace through the lens of solidarity. I come originally from Poland, and this notion of solidarity was extremely important at the time of solidarity movement. It highlights the importance of fundamental values and the principles for the society. Which values and principles do you consider to be in danger, or to be important to create the good governance of the future work? And why do you think so?
I think there's not one answer to your question about what right is challenged. I think by the transformations that we are seeing in our societies and in the domain of work, changes how benefits and costs and entitlements and duties are distributed across our societies, but also within our societies. And what we do by foregrounding sort of a solidaristic lens is to say that at an age, at an era where everything is personalized, where we have personalized phones and personalized preferences and personalized services and so on and so on, it could be tempting to say that we all live in our own bubble as it is, and we forget how we are related to others. I don't mean this in the sense that we should all hold hands and love each other, but I mean it in the sense that our interests and who we are shaped by our relationship to our environments, to our human and social and artifactual environments. And I think we should create policies and institutions, and this includes also environmental politics, that take these relations into consideration, and that also take into consideration that we have happier societies and happier people if, when it comes to meeting people's fundamental needs and interests, those of us who are in stronger positions should continue to support the weaker, regardless of whether people in weaker positions display quote unquote unhealthy behaviors or deviant behaviors. So I think the whole idea of measuring behavior at an individual level and then trying to tackle it by nudging is an ideological decision to blame people in who are in non-privileged positions. And I think those who are in more privileged positions need to stand up and say, we don't want that. We want societies where we support each other, and we want societies that distribute goods and benefits and duties and entitlements fairly. And let's have a discussion of what we consider fair. And let's not be sidetracked by, you know, looking at the data and saying, oh, those people smoke, so they shouldn't get healthcare, and those people eat too much. Those people do other things that we consider as in some way not very valuable. So I think we need digital data, but we should use them at the collective level to help us build better institutions that will benefit everyone, to decrease social injustices. And we should sort of utilize the power of data for these public collective benefits.
We got the question from one of the persons who are remotely taking part in this discussion, who asked, what do you think about the following statement? Can we consider that the manager who uses the system to evaluate the performance of the employees runs away from his own role and responsibility of being the manager, so giving this managing power to the machine or to the system instead? That's a question to all the panelists.
This is Iha. I can weigh in a little bit on that. I think what we've seen is actually these systems are replacing managers. A lot of middle management, at least in the US context, has no longer exists because these systems do the evaluation, not just evaluation, but scheduling of employee time based on the customer flows. And so that is, yes, definitely the primary role has disappeared. But secondly, it becomes a way of distancing the company from some of the behaviors and some of the actions that could result. So, you know, this might actually be something that is purposeful in order to create that distance. Potentially, one means of doing that is sort of being able to say that they are not employees, as is in the case with, and I'm sure the European context is very different from the US, in the ways that, you know, some ride-hailing companies or delivery companies determine that people working on those platforms are not employees, but independent contractors that are doing work on their own, and their ratings are based on entirely upon their performance and nothing else.
And what should be the policy response to that? Do you think that we could or should come up with some response?
I think that technology in that sense of misclassification is being used as a rhetorical tool as opposed to a technological tool to misclassify workers. And in the US, the debate is happening right now within local municipalities, but also in the court. But this is, you know, this is, I think, something that I want to bring up about some of these technology tools is they're oftentimes reinforcing social problems that already existed. Taxi drivers were independent contractors before Uber and Lyft arrived on the scene. Domestic workers were excluded from collective bargaining and protections for minimum wage. So oftentimes they're existing in a space where there is already a lack of sufficient regulatory oversight. So I think that if anything is opening a much bigger conversation about precarity of work and some of the situations that maybe don't exist in Europe, but exist in the US and hopefully will not be exported anywhere else.
Perhaps I could come in there.
Yes, of course. Ursula, you've been taking part in a lot of discussion on the European Union level. Will we find answers to this in upcoming time? Do we wait for these answers right now?
Now, your question in a way brought together some of the points that Barbara made and the point that I have made, which is that we cannot really separate out the technology from the kind of social and economic context, if you like, in which it's in which it's deployed, and that certainly the use of these digital, the algorithmic management, you could say, is on the one hand, it's sidelining managers, as Ihale was saying. On the other hand, it is very going absolutely against the grain of the what you were saying earlier about, and Barbara was saying about the importance of solidarity, because as it as workers are set against each other and compared with each other on the basis of these abstract indicators, they are put into competition with each other, and the more they're in competition with each other, the harder it is to develop solidarities. And we are increasingly kind of seeing a situation where the ideal worker, if you like, is constructed as a kind of an independent entrepreneur who goes into the labour market on their own, and they compete with all the other independent entrepreneurs, and the person with the sharpest elbows wins. And these are social values that they might work in some sectors, but in like service industries, it does a lot of social harm, actually. I would much rather be looked after by a care worker who gets their job satisfaction from doing a good job, or rather from, you know, competing successfully with a colleague. So it seems to me that we have to unpick at a policy level this whole discourse about self-employment and entrepreneurship. There clearly are genuine freelancers, and many of them in Europe, and it's important that they have a clear legal status. And it seems to me that it would be perfectly possible in most countries to define a self-employed worker, an autonomous worker who has the right to set their own rates of pay, who has the right to pass work down to a subordinate or a colleague, and who is, if you like, a genuine freelancer. And to construct a definition that is valid both in terms of employment law and for tax purposes and for social protection purposes would be very useful, because there are a lot of contradictions at the moment. But then, once having established that definition of a genuine freelancer, then it seems to me that what we need to do is to say that everybody else, it should be regarded as a default position as a dependent worker, and that dependent workers should have certain collective rights, some of which are already there in some European countries, and or covered by European directives, like the right to a minimum wage, the right to paid holidays, the right to call in a health and safety inspector if the working conditions are dangerous, and so on. There are a lot of, if you like, traditional employee rights that have been very much eroded that should be applied more universally. But I think we also crucially need a new set of rights to do with the right to know how your data are being used, the right to have it destroyed if you stop working for that employer, the right to challenge unfair customer ratings, the right to challenge being arbitrarily dropped from a platform without even knowing the reason you've been dropped, which is the case I've come across many times in the research that we've done. And it seems to me that it's not good enough to sort of try to create a special legal category of platform worker, which some people are arguing we need to do, and to give them kind of special protection and special rights, because the business models are changing so fast and the practices are so widespread now. You have, on the one hand, the online platforms behaving more and more like regular companies because the regulators are starting to regulate them, and because workers are starting to organise, especially the workers who get to meet each other on the streets, like delivery workers and drivers. So you've got the platforms being more and more pulled into line, if you like, in Europe, and being asked to behave more like regular employers. But then on the other hand, you've got all the regular employers behaving more and more like platforms, with the exponentially rapid spread of all the kind of practices that have been, in some cases, pioneered by platforms. In some cases, they were around before that, but they are developing so fast and becoming the new normal. So what we need is universal rights, it seems to me, for all dependent workers in relation to these new algorithmic management practices. And any attempt to say that platform workers are a special kind of worker, it seems to me, is doomed to failure.
You said about collective rights and about new collective rights to be created, or new ways to answer in this paradigm. Well, I have a question to Aiha. Do you think that there is a possibility to use the platform by the employees? Can employees create, let's say, algorithmic, artificial, intelligent trade union software that would be able to platform-like assess what the employers do? Can the fact that this data is still all around mean that it can be used also for collective actions by the employees, by the workers?
That's a very interesting question. I think that there have been some efforts that have been somewhat successful of employees using and creating or working with technologists to create their own apps that allow them to get some of that information so they can make better informed decisions. A couple things come into mind. Walmart workers started an app which allowed them to crowdsource information about essentially creating their own employee handbook, because the company was not really being very clear about what their rights were to sick time or hours and pay. And that's part of, you know, what I think Barbara and Ursula have brought out about sort of this dynamic changes in this technology, that workers don't have a clear understanding of their parameters of work. And so they're using different technical and digital tools in order to get there. So I think that there is definitely a desire to think about how do we organize when we are a dispersed workforce, and how do you build power when these tools are very much about customization and individual actions, and there's a desire there. I think that what's going to be tough is most of the information is still held by companies, and workers being able to say take their individual data isn't really going to give them that collectiveness that it's a collective problem of a company having their collective data, that their individual data doesn't help in that way. So I think that needs to be part of their consideration. And another thing is that when we're thinking about worker protections, we have to think about worker power. How does the shifting of power dynamics through technology make it more difficult for workers to fight for those protections? And I think that I'm not sure I have a question for that. I think that's what people are really trying to get at. Like, what is that lever that gives workers more power so they can shift that situation?
Thank you very much. Can we now go to kind of conclusions? Can I give 2 minutes per each of you to conclude this part of the discussion part? Because I still have two or three subjects that I wanted to touch during this discussion, but they have to be left. Can I ask you, Barbara, to start with conclusions of this short meeting?
Yeah, thank you, Wojciech. I think what is very clear is that, as Ursula was saying, we need some new rights. The way we think about human rights protections has been very, very helpful so far. But now that we live in the digital era, the way we protect some of the rights, the instruments we use, need to be reconsidered. And there are debates going on individual, one of those, such as, you know, this big debate about what does privacy mean today. It's clearly not dead. I think what some people mean when they say what does privacy is dead is that the way that we have been protecting it is no longer fit for purpose. And the second point is one that all three of us have mentioned, and Aiha has just highlighted that in the final part of her comment. We need clearly to protect individuals, but people are individuals and they're part of families, communities at the same time. And we clearly need, if we want to tackle some of the most difficult problems and the most harmful problems, We need, besides individual level solutions, we need collective solutions. We need collective instruments, collective oversight, and collective ownership in a moral sense, and maybe also in a legal sense of digital data and of data practices.
But perhaps I could come in here, because it seems to me that those of us who do research on what's happening in the labour market in Europe at the moment, we tend to see the negative side, because a lot of this platform work is done by people who are very poor, who are in very difficult circumstances, who have really very bad experiences that they tell us about. But it seems to me that the technology in principle could, under different forms of control, developed in a more bottom-up democratic way, could be actually a solution to an awful lot of the economic and social challenges that we're facing in Europe right now. In particular, if you look at what the majority of platform workers are actually doing, the ones who are visible on the streets tend to be the Deliveroo riders and the Foodora riders and Uber drivers and so on, but greatly exceeding them in numerically are a much larger army of workers, some of whom are working in the privacy of their own homes for online platforms in a global labour market, but many of whom are doing work in other people's homes, like cleaning, like gardening, like childcare, elder care, and so on, who are basically doing the social reproduction work, which in many cases before the financial crisis was being delivered by public sector workers, which have been cut because of austerity. And I think if we could think imaginatively about platforms as offering us the potential to create, if you like, a digital welfare state at maybe the city level or the regional level, it could be used very, very positively. The same technology that enables a Deliveroo rider to bring you exactly the meal that you want at the moment you want could be used to deliver a meal to an elderly person who's just out of hospital and can't cook. It could be used to deliver an emergency babysitter for somebody whose childcare arrangements have fallen apart. It could be used very, very constructively. And at the moment, we have these services being delivered increasingly, that what used to be in the informal economy becoming part of this marketized formal economy run by online platforms. But like 25% of the value of each transaction at the moment is being hoovered out of Europe and then going to some company in California or wherever. That 25% could stay in the local community if it were a local platform organized in a bottom-up way. And that 25% could be used to create better working conditions for the workers, to integrate the services with what are at the moment the public services that are under such stress in the city, to develop initiatives, for instance, to charge less for these services to the needy and to charge more for people who can afford them, and so on. It seems to me that what we need really are some experiments in locally based platforms, perhaps municipal platforms, perhaps public-private partnerships, to develop alternative models that give the control of the services back to local communities, and also to give the value that is created as a result of the efficiencies of these technologies, to share that also back with local communities, but both with service users and with service workers.
Thank you very much. And Aiha, you are the last speaker in this a final round, so give us the point of view from the other side of the Atlantic as well.
All right. And my view is probably going to come more from the advocate position, which is, I think, like we've mentioned from the very beginning, these are tools. They're not, as Barbara said, they're not natural in any way. And so for me, it's about these tools being fair and accountable to the workers. And I think the only way that that can be the case, whether it's, you know, a worker on a gig platform or a worker in retail whose schedule is being dictated by an algorithm, workers need to be at the table for the design of the system to actually benefit both sides. They're not going to go away. I don't think anyone in doing this work believes that somehow we're going to go back to an era when this wasn't the situation. But I think, you know, there is an opportunity for us to determine the course moving forward, and that the best way for that to happen is to actually have workers at the table making those decisions.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the whole conversation, for the information that you passed and the ideas that you passed, and have a good afternoon. All the best from the EDPS office.